What's important about that and interesting for the Alderses is that when they got to America, they did not want to be pigeonholed as Bauhaus artists. They didn't want to have labels put on them. So in a way, they kind of distanced themselves a little bit from the idea of Bauhaus or being called Bauhaus. It was quite a subtle thing, but they didn't want to be known simply as Bauhaus artists. They wanted to make their own way in America. And they did. I have been the chief curator at the Joseph and Annie Albers Foundation in the U.S. In a small town called Bethany.
This was Brenda Danilowitz, and I'm Anja Guttenberger, host of this podcast, Bauhaus Faces. Welcome to a new episode of Bauhaus Faces. I'd like to present my second double episode about a Bauhaus power couple, Annie and Joseph Albers. It just makes sense to tell their stories in one piece too, because like the lives of Ethel and Ernst Mittag, my first double episode, their lives too are closely knit together, at least from 1922 onwards. Joseph was one of the first persons she met when Anneliese Elsa Frieda Fleischmann arrived in Weimar. About him, Annie would later say, "He was one of the older students. He was very thin and very aesthetic looking." In 1925, Joseph was already part of the Bauhaus teaching staff as a so-called Jungmeister, a young master, and head of the forecourse of the preliminary course. Annie studied in the weaving workshop. That was the year when they finally got married. Anneliese Fleischmann shortened her first name and now became Annie Albers, a very Bauhaus name in its sound, right? When Gunther Stölzl, head and only proclaimed female master at the Bauhaus, left in 1931, and by the way, you can listen to a full episode about Gunther Stölzl here on the Bauhaus Faces podcast too, Annie Albers took over, the beginning of her teaching career. While Annie Albers was a Christian Protestant, by the Nazis she was still considered a Jew because her ancestors were Jewish. This put both Annie and Joseph Albers in great danger when in January of 1933, Adolf Hitler and the Nazi Party came to power. When the Bauhaus was closed for good in 1933, by that time Joseph had become vice director to the third Bauhaus director, Mies van der Rohe. The opportunity to become teachers in the newly founded Black Mountain College in the US offered them a way out. There, they helped create the face of the new school and deeply shaped it with their teaching approaches that they had brought from the Bauhaus. They stayed until 1949. In the 1930s and 50s, the Albers went on several trips to Mexico, where both were very much inspired by pre-Columbian ornaments and architecture. They both processed this in their art, Joseph in painting, Annie in weaving and in jewelry. In 1950, the Alberses moved to Connecticut, where Joseph started teaching at Yale University and became head of the newly formed Department of Design. Annie became a freelance weaver. She soon gave up weaving herself and followed new paths into designing textile patterns for Florence Knowles Company, and in the 1970s for Sunard Textiles. She designed a series of abstract geometrical textiles. In this podcast episode, Brenda Danilowitz, chief curator at the Joseph and Annie Albers Foundation, will help me tell the story of this Bauhaus couple. So, let's dive into a new episode of Bauhaus Faces and shine a light on Annie and Joseph Albers.
So Annie and Joseph actually met at the Bauhaus in 1922. She arrived there. She was quite a bit younger than him. She came from a very well-known bourgeois, upper bourgeois Berlin family, the Ullstein family. Her mother was an Ullstein. They, of course, are very well known and still well known today for the Ullstein Verlag. As she grew up, they were publishers of numerous newspapers, magazines, something like we would say in the United States, like the New York Times today, or maybe even bigger than that. So she grew up in that environment. She lived in Charlottenburg. But she always pushed against her, the sort of bourgeois nature of her family, and wanted to do something different, and she wanted to be an artist. Her parents encouraged her, and she took some private art classes. She went to school in Charlottenburg to a private girls' school there. And then she looked around for an art school. And this was around about 1920-1921. And it was very difficult for women to get accepted into art schools at the time. So one of the schools that did accept women was the Kunstgewerbeschule in Hamburg. And so they packed her off to the Kunstgewerbeschule in Hamburg. But things did not go very well there. She enrolled there in 1921 and was there for two semesters, I think one school year. And she complained that she was only learning to do sewing and embroidery, and she did not like it. Whether that is correct, we've since learned that actually the Kunstgewerbeschule was teaching a lot of other things at the time. Whether she didn't want to be among so many women, it's not very clear what it was, but she said, this is not for me. Mm-hmm. So back she came to Berlin, where she had heard about this new school called the Bauhaus by this time, because through a school friend, I believe, who had given her some information, because the Bauhaus, of course, was by 1921-22, it was getting itself established. She did not know much about the Bauhaus, but off she went to Weimar, and the first thing, almost the first person she met there was this very handsome young man who was working in the glass workshop. And not only handsome, but he was a very charismatic, dynamic guy who knew exactly where he wanted to go, and his name was Josef Albers. She totally was, you know, entranced by him, and he was more than 10 years older than her, so someone that she looked up to. He had been there since 1921, and he had established himself in what had been the glass workshop, although glasswork was not actually being taught much there, but that was what he wanted to do. He came from a completely different background to her. He was from North Rhine-Westphalia, from the Ruhr region, from a very small mining town called Bottrop, very close to Essen is the biggest town near it. And he had grown up in the house of his parents, and his father was an artisan, or what is known as a Meistermaler, a builder, a tinkerer, who worked through, in those days, the guild system, and so had many apprentices working with him and living in the house when he grew up. And so Josef grew up in this house and went to school there. His parents wanted him to be a school teacher. So he learned the trades from his father. And one thing he learned from his father was how to paint. Mm-hmm. But how to paint in a craftsmanly way, if you can think of, you know, painting the doors in a house. And he told the story about how his father had taught him that when you paint the inside panels of the door, you start in the center and you paint very carefully outwards so that your sleeves don't get paint on them.
That's very clever.
And so when you think about it, Josef Albers, I can jump to the end of his life, and he did eventually become a painter and is now today famous for painting squares. Right. And when I say squares, they are paintings that consist of different color squares layered inside each other. And because he had had this amazing training at careful work, he would paint these squares without putting down any tape or without creating a line. He would draw the lines himself with his paintbrush, fill in the squares, move from the center to the outside exactly as his father had told him when he was a young boy. Yes, and today there is a museum dedicated to him in the town of Bottrop. It is a town museum. In 1983, the town came to Annie Albers, because Josef died in 1976. So after his death, the people from the town of Bottrop came to the United States, and I'll fill in that part of the story for you in a little bit, and suggested to Annie Albers that they would like to make a museum in his honor, which they did. And the Albers Foundation gave to the city of Bottrop a large group of Albers's work as the foundations of that museum. And it's since grown and developed further. And in October 2022, they had added a brand new section of the building that's the most fantastic architecture, beautifully designed specifically for Albers's work. And it's situated in a park on the outskirts of Bottrop. And anybody who comes from that region or lives nearby should definitely pay a visit, because it's quite a landmark. It's a new landmark, but it's absolutely fantastic. So his heritage and his legacy is still growing throughout the world, and certainly back in his hometown, which he would have been really happy about, because he did have a kind of a sentimental attachment to it, which grew throughout his life. Josef Albers had become a school teacher in Bottrop, but he wanted something bigger than that. And so he, while working as a school teacher, he would take leave from his position and get his salary paid so he could go off to study further. So he did go to Berlin in 1915 to study at the Königliche Kunstschule in Berlin, where he learned painting from a teacher called Philipp Frank, who had a big influence on his life. And then he heard about the Bauhaus, and something about it attracted him, because it was a combination of being an artist, which he wanted to be, and also of this idea of building, which he had inherited from his father. So in 1921, he set out for the Bauhaus and entered the glass workshop, because he had done some work in stained glass also as an artisan and was keen to develop that part of his work. And Gropius, quite soon after Albers arrived, could see that Albers had the qualities that it took to be a teacher. Albers was really a born teacher. And this became, towards the end of his life or in his middle years, he really wanted to be an artist. So there was always this feeling of, should he be more of a teacher and less of an artist, or more of an artist and less of a teacher? And he eventually was able to balance these two sides of his work in an amazing way. He was a very skillful teacher, because he was so devoted to explaining to people and allowing his students to understand what it was that inspired him as an artist, and he was a great communicator. So Annie Albers did have to get through the Vorkurs before she could be assigned to a workshop, and it was not very easy for her. She had trouble. The first time she took the Vorkurs qualifying test, she did not pass it.
Oh, right. You could do that more than one time. I didn't know.
Apparently she could. But by this time, Josef was teaching the Vorkurs. So he took her under his wings and he explained to her what was needed, because, of course, she had been a student as a school girl, and then after she finished school, studying painting, but this was not, painting was not what you needed to know to be a member of the Bauhaus community. And many of the artists and the women artists also who came to the Bauhaus had had some other kind of art training in schools, not exactly the same way, but they had a better feel for what it was to be in an art school or a school of design. And she did not have this experience apart from her apparently unsuccessful time in Hamburg. So Josef said, don't worry, I'll get you into this thing. So the second time she took the test, she was successful. And then she joined in 1922 or 23. We're not sure exactly of what the date was. She joined the weaving workshop, which, as you may have read or may know, has been sort of characterized as where all the women were pushed into to work because of it being women's work. And that is a controversial subject. And there certainly were women who did not enter the weaving workshop, like Marianne Brandt, Vera Meyer-Waldeck, women who did carpentry and metalwork. But the majority of the women students were part of the weaving workshop. Of course, for Annie, she was trying to escape from this bourgeois, grand bourgeois world that she lived in. So for her, the Bauhaus, with the austerity, the lack of money and so on, was actually an advantage, because she wanted to be, I wouldn't say she wanted to be poor, but she did not like the privileged life that she had been leading. That was not the life she wanted. So she comes to the Bauhaus and she meets this poor artisan from the other side of the country, you know, and the distinction between Bottrop and Berlin in those days was, it was another world. Mm. But to get back to the weaving workshop, she also did not want to be part of the painting workshop because they were doing wall painting and she was not very athletic and she didn't want to climb up a ladder. She did not want to do that. And so, as she said in her own words, well, she wasn't that happy about it because she thought that weaving was for women and was sissy. It wasn't, I don't know if what the German word would be, that it wouldn't be, you know, a really kind of constructive kind of work. But as she said, I took these threads and I learned to understand them and to talk to them. And anybody who actually knows or has tried to do weaving would understand that weaving is not at all something easy to do. It requires a lot of physical strength, in fact, but the way it was taught at the Bauhaus, it also requires a lot of ingenuity and design. So when the Bauhaus opened in Weimar, one of the reasons that weaving became an immediate place for women to go was that the Weimar Bauhaus was based on an older school from before the First World War. So Walter Gropius, when he came to Weimar, he took over this existing school, which had kind of ceased to exist because of the war, and his vision was to change this into a modern school. Well, he had to build up everything from scratch with not a lot of resources of money, but the one thing that existed in the old school was a weaving workshop. They had some looms, they had some equipment, and so this was the most well-equipped part of the original 1919 Bauhaus when it began. So obviously they were going to use this, and they gradually shifted from weaving in an older method, which was more or less copying existing patterns and simply operating these machines, to eventually in Dessau seeing weaving as a constructive, creative process, not copying other people's weavings, but developing their own new ways, new patterns, new images, in line with the movement towards abstraction and design, which was becoming very prominent in the 20s, was like the golden age of abstract art, as we kind of think of it now. After she'd been there 1 or 2 years, they got married in 1925. In typical Bauhaus fashion, she wanted to modernize her name. So, in fact, she was not only Annie Fleischmann, she was Annalisa Fleischmann. And then she could have this very perfect Bauhaus name, Annie Albers. We do have one of her earliest works. We don't definitively know whether we could date it to 1923-22, maybe more 23-24, but it is a very dark, abstract construction in black and white, very geometric. By 1929, of course, Annie was a very experienced weaver. She had made some amazingly beautiful geometric wall hangings. And the other part of that, which I just want to express, is that weaving is not only a technical constructive thing, but also it has to do with counting and numbers, because weaving, basic to weaving, is knowing how many threads you're using and how the threads interlace. And as Annie Albers later wrote, it's a very simple thing. It's horizontal threads, vertical threads, which are called the warp, being run across with horizontal threads, which are called the weft. And the pattern that emerges is completely determined by what materials you use. And in this very basic If you think way of creating a grid, but the imaginative use of materials and of color, you can do so much with them. The other thing that she had learned by then, and certainly after Hannes Meyer came in 27, I think, was that Hannes Meyer emphasized that weaving should be about construction. He talked about structio stoffa. So he emphasized that this is not about making pictures. This is not about decoration. This is not about making even tablecloths or table mats or household domestic things. Weaving is connected to construction. And Annie Aldous took up this message very strongly. So many years later, she would write about weaving as an ally of architecture, the relationship between building a weaving and building a building. And so when Hannes Meyer came to her, and this is how she told the story, Hannes Meyer came to me and he asked me to devise a textile that would both absorb all the sounds, but also reflect the light in the aula, in the hall of the trade union school, where they would have lectures, they would also have concerts, musical concerts, they would even show films in the early days. So it was a very all-purpose auditorium, let's say, which is quite common in still in schools. You have an auditorium and you put on plays there, or you have music productions and so on. So Hannes Meyer came to her possibly because he recognized that she understood this idea of a structural textile. So what did she do? She created a very simple weave pattern. So this was nothing fancy in terms of twisting threads or using different colors or anything like that. She just looked for materials that she thought would be able to do this architectural job of making the sounds less muffled and clearer, and at the same time not being dark so that everything is enveloped in darkness. Because in those days, as she said, usually theaters had, in order to have some kind of acoustic muffling of sounds, would be made out of velvet. And it would always be a dark velvet. And I think everybody's been to a theater where there was a red velvet curtain in the front of the stage. And Annie didn't like curtains. She liked panels. Panels were structural. She would not use a curtain. And this continued into her later life and her later experience with architectural-related projects. Anyway, so she looked for materials that would absorb the sound but would also reflect the light. And she devised a way of taking a warp that was black, so thin black threads in the vertical dimension of the textile, and threading through them as the weft two different materials. One would be a soft, kind of fluffy material called chenille in a white or whitish color, and the other one would be a shiny material which reflected light, either a kind of raffia or cellophane, which was being used at the Bauhaus because they were looking in the weaving workshop, they were using cellophane, they were using all of these new materials. But she managed to unite these two materials in a very simple and effective way, so that the soft side would be against the wall, so it would keep the sound at bay, and the shiny side would be facing outwards into the audience. And because of the way that she chose those materials, which is not only the qualities of the materials, but the thickness or the thinness of the materials, the warp was very thin, but it was very strong, the vertical black, and then having these lighter colors intersect with the black, if you looked at it from afar and you didn't come up close and see what it was really made of, it looks silver. And so it shone in a silver way, and it must have had the most dramatic effect on the interior of the auditorium, but it also did the job. She was incredibly proud of this thing that she had done in later life. One aspect of it was that she had taken it, or the Bauhaus had taken this fabric to the Zeiss Icon workshops. So they produced cameras and they were able to photograph it, but also to measure the amount of light that got reflected off of the surface. And this was, again, very much in Hannes Meyer's methodology of scientifically examining what you were making and proof of it. And she was incredibly proud of this object, of this material that she'd made. What we don't know is, you know, she didn't just walk into the workshop one morning and say, oh, here's this material, I'm going to make it. Obviously, this took a lot of intuitive thinking, a lot of experience that she had now by this time, and was very deliberate. And Hannes Meyer somehow knew that she was the person who would be able to do this. But what we know about Annie was that this work was something that she referred to again and again in her teaching. We have very few examples of what else was she did, so we can't tell. There's only one that survives, which is a much finer but also really beautiful and intricate kind of design in that way, was a piece of fabric that she had given to Lionel Feininger at the time, and which stayed in the Feininger family until several years ago when I went to visit Lux Feininger, Lionel Feininger's son, in Cambridge, Massachusetts, where they lived. And he said, just a minute, and I think at that stage he was over 80, and he lived in this house with lots of stairs, and he went running up the stairs, and he came running down, and he brought a little box, and it said Annie Albers on it, and he opened it up, and there was this fabric, quite a fine fabric, with the little round Bauhaus Dessau logo on it. After all those years, he then gave it to the Albers Foundation, so we now have it in our collection. So that is the only other survival of that period that we know.
Those of you who are regular listeners of Bauhaus Faces, you already know that I've produced an episode. In fact, it was the very first one about Tilux Feininger, featuring him and his very, very charming son, Conrad. For those who don't know, now you do. And maybe this will be your next episode of Bauhaus Faces that you're listening to. Now let's go back to the Albuses before you decide to switch to Tilux, okay? While Brenda extensively talked about Annie Albers' work at the Bauhaus, about her textiles and which ones have survived and or are known today, what did Joseph do during his studies at the Bauhaus? So, when he enrolled at the Bauhaus in 1920, he studied with the big names that were meant to pull as many students as possible into the newly founded school. The avant-garde artists Paul Klee, Wassily Kandinsky, Lionel Feininger, Johannes Itten and Oskar Schlemmer. Joseph became part of the glass workshop at the Bauhaus. He produced assemblages and became a master craftsman for glass. If you're curious of what a glass composition of Joseph Albers might look like, I recommend to go to the Grassi Museum in Leipzig, Germany. In 1927, Joseph was now a Bauhaus master and had moved to Dessau with the Bauhaus. He created an ensemble of 18 glass windows for the museum's staircase. Though they were destroyed during World War II in 1943, they were reconstructed in 2011. If you're listening through Apple Podcasts, you can see now a photo of the windows on your screen that I took a few years ago. The design of the windows is a design that is consistently based on the geometric shape of the square and, as yet, rich in variety. Joseph will pick up this topic later on in his painting series, Homage to the Square. The visual appeal, in effect, is truly amazing and offers a veritable introduction to the museum's collection, whose one focus is on the arts and crafts of the 1920s and 1930s. I have to jump back in time now a little bit, but just a few years to 1923, when Joseph Albers was still a student at the Bauhaus. Soon, Walter Gropius understood that he needed to convince this extraordinary person to stay. When Johannes Itten left the Bauhaus, he offered him the position of the fall course teacher, a shared position with the Hungarian artist Laszlo Moholy-Nagy. As a trained teacher, Joseph Albers was now able to fully develop his skills. Let's listen to what Brenda tells us about Albers' teaching concept at the Bauhaus and how he then took this knowledge and helped build a completely new school in the U.S., the Black Mountain College.
He quickly caught on to what was really the basis of Bauhaus education, which was materials. We start with materials, whether it's thread, whether it's metal, whether it's paper, And of course, as I said, they didn't have a lot of resources. So he actually started off with paper, something that was less expensive, quite easily available. You could take an old newspaper if you wanted to make something with paper. So the idea was to take a material and to use it to build something, some kind of a structure that was original, that was strong, that had all these characteristics of what a building or what construction should be. Not so much a physical building at that point, but building, making something out of material, any material. One of the most famous photographs of Joseph Albers is him in his classroom in Weimar with all of these little paper models. But there were rules. There were rules to be obeyed. So the students were instructed. They would come into the classroom and there would be a pile of paper and they were to make something out of it. But they were not allowed to cut it or paste it or pin it together. They had to twist it or manipulate the paper in some way to create a structure. And the other part of his technique as a teacher was then at the end of the day or the end of the class, everybody put out their work. If it was paper sculptures, they would be on the floor. And he would go around and he would point out which ones were the successful ones and which ones were not. And he could communicate so clearly, you know, not just like some art teachers do, scratch their head and say, that's interesting, or that's, you know, I quite like this, but, you know, he was extremely clear thinking about what he wanted, what the goals of his teaching were, and to instill in his students this idea of working with materials, not to create something that they'd seen somewhere else or that existed somewhere else, or looking over to the person next to them to see what they were doing, but to think about material in a very rigorous way and to invent new ways, just to use materials, I would say, to make objects. So the idea, the goal of this teaching and this understanding of materials was to create form. Form, which is a kind of an abstract concept, but that was the way they expressed it. And Albers, in 1928, published a very important article. It was only 3 or 4 pages long in a journal for teaching. I think it was in Leipzig. There was an exhibition that he had exhibited in. But this article, which has become almost the basis of thinking about all of form construction at the Bauhaus, was called Werkliche Formunterricht. That was his description of what he did. And the first part of it was, tell the students to forget everything they'd ever learned before. Forget about trying to make art. You're not making art. You are understanding materials and how to work with materials. And even if they'd been to other art schools, they were told to, you know, forget it.
Joseph Albers was not only a teacher who influenced many Bauhaus students with his four-course experiments and a prolific glassmaster, he was also interested in photography. Some of you already know from my other podcast episodes that photography at the Bauhaus is what I've been researching the most during the past 16 years. At the Bauhaus, Joseph started to take portraits of friends and later of landscapes or architecture. He would then combine the photo series into a pattern, mostly a combination of a few bigger photos and several smaller ones. This way he created a film scene moment without using a film camera. These assemblages very much resemble the windows at the Grassi Museum that I have talked about a bit earlier in this episode, in their structure at least. In the landscape and architecture photos, he produces a panoramic view without using a wide lens. There's, for example, a series of a toddler, Andreas Grote, with his mother from 1930, an undated series of Tenayuca, a pre-Columbian Mesoamerican archaeological site in the Valley of Mexico that on one side shows various perspectives of the place and on the other side puts together stone structures of the architectural surfaces. And then there's another photo collage labeled Aspen, Summer 1951. It is in fact 3 series in one, a panoramic view of Aspen and then one series about Joseph and one with photos of Annie Albers in it. This might have only been their private photo album. The construction of the photos, though, is very special. It puts them in relation to each other and tells a story on their own, no additional words needed. Admittedly, Joseph Albers was not the only person at the Bauhaus who did that. If you go to the Bauhaus archives in Berlin or Dessau, you will find several photo albums, I'm sure, or sheets of other Bauhauslers in the same manner. Etel Foto Mittag, and yes, there's also an episode about her and her husband Ernst Mittag on my Bauhaus Faces podcast available, and Hannes Meyer come to my mind. But none of them did it in such a way that their photos became like a short film to experience what Joseph Albers had experienced while taking the photos. This is really special, and it's up to his painting and glasswork that are both strongly marked by the serial element. He also took photos of several pre-Columbian artifacts on their travels and did a series of color photo portraits at Black Mountain College when everybody dressed up for a costume party. Really funny photos. I will link you an article about those mask portraits by Joseph Albers in comparison to Gertrud Arndt's mask portraits that she had done at the Bauhaus that I wrote for Bauhaus Imaginista a few years ago. Anyway, as you all know, the end of the Bauhaus came in April 1933. Joseph Albers had been one of the few people who had lived the Bauhaus from the very beginning until the end, guided by three different directors over a time span of 13 years. Joseph stayed as the vice Bauhaus director until the very end. With the Nazis now labeling his wife Annie as Jewish, as her ancestors were Jewish but had converted to Protestantism even before Annie Albers was born, so now it's not understandable anymore, the situation became more and more dangerous for them.
Annie actually left a little earlier and was working from home. She had a loom in her apartment. They had moved into an apartment in Berlin. Joseph stayed on until the end, which was the beginning of 1933. Annie had, I think, left in 1931 when Günther Stölzl had her child. Annie briefly took over running the weaving workshop, and then probably in 1932, she set up her loom at home. They were trying to work out what they were going to do next. Would they be able to survive as artists or artisans or designers in this new world, which the Bauhaus, where they had spent their entire married life up until that point, how were they going to keep going? Could Joseph still teach? What would he make? Where would he get commissions? Because the world was changing rather rapidly at the time. By 1933, we know Adolf Hitler had been elected to be the vice chancellor. So there were a lot of rumblings of what was going to happen. So in the meantime, they met in Berlin Philip Johnson, the American architect who had been one of the people who had started the Museum of Modern Art, MoMA, today's MoMA in New York. Philip Johnson was one of the people who had advised the Rockefellers to create this museum, and he had visited Germany several times. He'd been to the Bauhaus to visit. He knew Mies. He was a great admirer of Mies's work, and I think had it in the back of his head to bring Mies to America at some point. And he had been to visit the Bauhaus and knew about Albers' teaching and had gone back to America and had asked Albers to send him some photographs of his student's work in the Forkers. So he was quite familiar with this. And one day, probably in 1932, Annie tells the story that she bumped into Philip Johnson on the street. Well, we don't know where she actually met him, but she had met him before. He said, well, what are you doing? And she said, I'm working out of my house. I'm doing weavings. And he said, okay, well, I would love to see your work. Mm-hmm. So she invited him to tea, and he came up to the house, and she took out some of her textiles to show him. And he said, oh, I've seen these, but I thought I was visiting with Lily Reich and Mies, and I thought these were made by Lily Reich. Now, we don't know exactly how true or apocryphal the story is, but this is the way that Annie Albers told it. And he said, well, this is, you know, amazing. He looked at her fabrics. He really appreciated them. And he said, well, you know, this could be your ticket to America. And that sunk into her head. He didn't make them an offer, but he was clearly really moved and appreciated of what she'd done. And then he went back to America. As Annie Albers tells it, one day, not long after she had met Philip Johnson on the street, and he'd been aware of her weavings and obviously was thinking about something, they got a telegram from America inviting them to come to a newly formed, very progressive college, to, you know, higher education, post-school college that had been formed by a small group of American academics who wanted to have freedom from the complicated administrations of universities and wanted to start their own college, led by a man called John Andrew Rice, to create a college where the teachers and the students would be equal and where there would be no administration over the teachers. The faculty would be the administrators. They would make the rules. They wouldn't be answerable to anyone. And so this enormously new opportunity. And somewhere in that telegram that they got was, this is a pioneering project. And Annie Alvers always said afterwards, when we heard the word pioneering, this is what we wanted. We wanted to go somewhere like the Bauhaus in a way, where nothing existed and we could make something of it. So they got terribly excited. And so they were offered positions because Rice, who started the school, was also a follower of John Dewey, the famous educationist and philosopher. And Dewey's method of teaching, which goes back again historically to Rousseau and other sort of educational theories, was that the idea was to, as it became a phrase, learning by doing. You learn through experience, you learn through making things. And of course, this was right up their alley. It was perfect for the Alverses because they believed in experience, experimentation, learning, whether it was weaving or painting or whatever it was. You learned something by doing it, not out of a book. And John Andrew Rice wanted making art in some way. He wasn't quite sure what it was he wanted, but he wanted this to be the core of this new school that he started. And through meeting Philip Johnson, he went to the Museum of Modern Art. Philip Johnson then told him, well, you know, he said, this is what I want to do. And Philip Johnson says, I've got the right person for you. And he pulls out the photographs that Alvers had sent him of the student work. And of course, there were all these crazy forms and different materials and different designs and so on. And on top of that, Annie Alvers, whose materials and fabrics Johnson had admired and thought she would be good to have at MoMA. And he said, here's your person, here's your man and your woman. So that was how they came to be invited to Black Mountain College. This was in the middle of 1933. Joseph could hardly speak English. Annie knew some English because she had had a governess at home and had been taught English at school, so she knew quite a bit of English. She had a completely different education from him. He said he knew no English, but he started to learn a little bit. And within months, they arrived in the United States in November of 1933. So in that brief period between, I think it was April that the Bauhaus finally closed, and they're sitting doing nothing. And November, they were on a ship. They were arriving in New York to take up this new position at this new school. So it was this amazing coincidence that these two things were happening at the same time. The end of the Bauhaus, the beginning of Black Mountain College, and they were there to start. The school actually started in September 1933, but the art classes only started after Joseph and Annie arrived and could get to Black Mountain College. Now, the one thing about Black Mountain College was this was not New York in 2023. This was Western North Carolina in 1933. So we're talking about, you know, 100 years ago. Mm-hmm. And of course, nothing was that developed. North Carolina was in the South. It was still segregated. It was very sparsely inhabited. But it was really beautiful. And the reason they went there was because they could get land and a place to create their school without very much money. This was also in the middle of the Depression. Nobody had any money, which was a good thing because everybody was starting from scratch. So there they were, you know, Joseph in his coat, Annie with her little hat on. There's a lovely photograph of them on the boat in New York Harbor, standing in front of the journalists, and it's what, Germans arrived to teach at Black Mountain College was the headline. And they spent a few days in New York. They were shown around and introduced to some other artists, and there were already a couple of Bauhaus, former Bauhaus students there. And then they got on the train, and off they went to this strange land with a strange habits and strange culture. Completely, I mean, you know, you couldn't think of anything more different than, you know, Black Mountain College in the mountains of Western North Carolina and the city of Berlin where they had been living. But this turned out to be the most amazing opportunity for them, as they suspected, and they made it. They made it happen. Annie had brought her loom with her. Mm-hmm. She had a loom that could be disassembled, and she had brought it with her on the ship from Europe. So she had a loom. They didn't really have any other equipment for weaving, but she started teaching weaving using, before they could acquire more looms, because they didn't have a lot of money and so on, but they started acquiring looms, which the students would share. She taught them material exercises, the kinds of things that could lead to weaving. You could kind of call it pre-weaving. In other words, using other materials to create the kind of designs that you could translate into a loom, into a woven thing on a loom once you had a loom. Two of the things that she did were make typewriter studies, which we know had been done at the Bauhaus, and so create patterns using typewriter characters, which could be looked at as a possible structure of a textile, and then using other materials like rolled up newspaper with string to create kind of objects that used materials and tested materials to see what could be made, until they started gradually getting looms. And of course, the college was never that big. I think they started off with 30 students in the whole college. So it wasn't like they needed an enormous amount of equipment at the time. And so she taught weaving, and she was the only weaving teacher really until towards the end. And they were at Black Mountain College until, from 1933 until 1949, that was a long time. Now, something else we should remember about them was that apart from the small, the sort of almost a year that they were living in their own apartment in Berlin, which was possibly paid for by Annie's parents, we're not sure about that, they had never had a household. They had met at the Bauhaus. It had been communal living. And now they come to Black Mountain College, and it was the same thing, communal living. There were a few structures, but the original building had been a kind of a church or some organization. And so they converted rooms into dormitories and into living quarters for the faculty. They all ate together. They slept together, probably. But it was a real community, almost like a kind of commune, where and nobody got paid very much. So when they hired faculty at Black Mountain College, they gave them a very small allowance, and it was very democratically determined. Like if a couple had a family, they would get more money than somebody who didn't. And then all of the meals were communal meals. Everything was shared, which is amazing. And it worked. Mm-hmm. It worked. And there were students who were on the board making decisions about what was taught at the school. So it was this extremely democratic movement, which was only possible, I think, at a time when the world and America was in flux because of depression and what had happened and would continue to happen, in fact, that next, you know, the decade of the 30s, right up until, you know, America joins the war in 1941, and so right through that whole period. And it was wonderful for them because they had this tremendous freedom. They had no board telling them what to do. And, you know, the students loved Joseph. So even the students who didn't want to be artists at least took his courses. And that was another thing about Black Mountain. They didn't have to really graduate. There weren't exams. If they wanted to get some kind of a diploma, they would have to take a more stringent course, and then they would get outside examiners to come in. And as the school progressed, of course, what happened? Gropius arrives at Harvard, Breuer arrives, Moholy Nagy arrives, and there's this whole influx of ex-Bauhaus people, and straight away they are all in touch with each other, And Joseph's going to Harvard to teach for Gropius because he always wanted Joseph to teach his students, and Gropius sends his students to Black Mountain College. So Harvard will accredit then, will give entry to someone who has graduated from Black Mountain College, which has no official sort of recognition, but because they were very rigorous about who they hired as faculty, and they were very careful to always include people who were from other schools and universities who would say, okay, I will give you your student, I will be the examiner for your student, and they would get certificates, and then they could go on to higher learning. And a lot of them became architects. A lot of the women had major sort of weaving careers. And the Black Mountain College story is another story which some people here may know, because there was a big exhibition at the Hamburger Bahnhof a few years ago, which was amazing. It's a different story, but it's in a way a continuation for them. And then, of course, as I say, the whole influx of refugees started coming from Europe. And what happened was that a lot of them gravitated to Black Mountain initially because some of them were friends of the Albuses and knew that they were there, because Gropius told some of them about this. And so it became this really cosmopolitan place in the middle of the South, the American South. And they would have summer institutes. So there were a lot of really well-known musicians would come there. They would have concerts. In a way, it was this union of the European ideas brought to Black Mountain, and was only possible at a time like that, I think. And just to go take that a bit further, after Gropius arrived, of course, he got invited to create an exhibition at the Museum of Modern Art in New York, 1938, which was called, incidentally, Bauhaus 1919 to 1928. And I think that a lot of people felt that that was the end of the Bauhaus in 1928. So the last 5 years are actually some of the most interesting years, because they were not really documented in the same way originally. Yeah, but what's important about that and interesting for the Albuses is that Joseph especially, who was there from 1920 till it closed, had gone through all of these stages of the Bauhaus. So really, in a way, he was one of the few people, not the only one, but one of the few people who had actually navigated all of this together with all of the politics of it and all of the complexities of it, and in a way kind of adapted to it, or not towards the end, maybe not so much, but really understood the Bauhaus idea, as did Annie. But I would want to stress, in spite of that, when they got to America, they did not want to be pigeonholed as Bauhaus artists. They didn't want to have labels put on them. So in a way, they kind of distanced themselves a little bit from the idea of Bauhaus or being called Bauhaus. It was quite a subtle thing, but they didn't want to be known simply as Bauhaus artists. They wanted to make their own way in America. And they did. And then they traveled to Latin America, which is another complete chapter in their lives. Early on, Annie had been taken to the Berlin Ethnological Museum by her father. Mm-hmm. On Sundays, they always went to museums. And one of the things that caught her eye and her imagination in the Ethnological Museum were the textiles from Latin America, and specifically mostly from Peru. And she had absorbed this lesson of these amazingly intricate, beautiful textile designs being created, first of all, by a population that had no written language, that could nevertheless make these incredibly complex textiles, but also that although they had no written language, they communicated through their textiles. Mm-hmm. And it was long before people had started to work out what these textiles actually meant, because that had been an ongoing process. But certainly a lot of these materials had been collected hugely in the 19th century. And if you go today to the new Humboldt Forum in Berlin, you can see the whole history of this almost mania for collecting and how that turned out. That is how she was brought up. Also, looking at these collections, which if you see photographs of the Ethnological Museum, things were just piled one on top of the other. You couldn't really see what they were, but she had set her eyes on this textiles. And so one of her great sort of wishes that she never knew would be fulfilled was to travel to these countries and to find out who were these people who were doing this work. And that was always at the back of her head.
The travels to Mexico had a real impact on Annie Albers. There are traces in her weavings that can be tracked back to the architecture of the Maya. In fact, Joseph Albers's most famous series, Homage to the Square, that he produced from 1950 onwards until his death in 1976, derives from what he saw in pre-Columbian ornaments and architecture. In 1956, Jean Chalot, a Mexican mural painter and friend to Joseph Albers, argued that within the Homage series, there was a hidden mystery. Quote, Albers favors these deceptive figures that the mind apprehends in one way, only to discover at a second reading new terms incompatible with the first ones and equally valid. Pyramidal shapes will be at the first convex, as monuments surveyed from a plane in flight, only to reverse themselves, become concave shells, their sides receding to the caved-in tip, as if it were a mummy's outlook from the burial chamber to the pyramid's outward slopes, end quote. I will link the article by Chalot for you in the show notes. And there's also an interesting article about the influence of pre-Columbian art on Joseph Albers's art by Joaquin Barrientos called Joseph Albers and the Pre-Columbian Artisan on bajosimaginista.org, which I will, of course, link in the show notes too. But what about Annie Albers? In what way did pre-Columbian arts and crafts and architecture influence her work? One might think it had only an effect on her weavings, and that is true, in fact. For example, the geometrical meandering ornaments of Mitla that the Alberses had seen on their journeys to Mexico directly translated into the weavings Red Meander from 1954 and Black White Gold One from 1950. I will link images of both weavings in the show notes. Annie even collected fragments of Andean textiles and took them home with her, in which meanders are one of the recurring patterns. But she also discovered something else that she couldn't get out of her head anymore: pre-Columbian jewelry, made of the simplest materials. In 1940, then, she united with one of her students from Black Mountain College, Alexander Reed. They created a jewelry line made of simple materials they found in hardware stores and five and dime shops, like washers, screws, angles, and color jacks. They would, for example, attach bobby pins to a plug chain between the small bead's one pin. That way, they created a fancy-looking collier. Another example is a necklace made of threaded washers on simple ribbon. It is the extraordinary way of threading and the shiny material of the ribbon that makes it look so special. If you want to try it yourself, I will link you a tutorial in the show notes. It's real fun, I promise. I used to do it in workshop with kids from the age of around 10 to 15 years. We always had the most amazing results, and these children were so proud of what they created.
And Joseph became a painter. He started painting, which he had not done at the Bauhaus, which had not really been possible to do. I mean, he didn't take Klee or Kandinsky's courses. The Bauhaus painting workshop was really more like house painting. And he said, well, I can do that. My father, I can do this. I don't need to go and learn how to paint, you know. But at Black Mountain, he started to take painting seriously. And color, he developed an interest in color, which had been something at the Bauhaus, and he knew about it. He'd never been that involved in it, but drawing on that experience of not only the sort of multiple aspects of Bauhaus education, but his knowledge of living close to Klee, Kandinsky, these who were major painters by this time, with great architects, with Gropius and so on. So he had this really rounded kind of complete experience that I think made him unique and made him unique as a teacher as well.
We are now slowly coming to an end of our podcast about Annie and Joseph Albers. Just to round up all of this, I will shortly summarize what happened after they left Black Mountain College in 1949. In 1950, Joseph was appointed head of the newly formed Department of Design at the Yale University, and the Alberses moved to New Haven. For the first time in their married life, they now had a house on their own. Joseph began to create his series, Homage to the Square, that we have mentioned several times in this podcast and that he would continue to do until his death in 1976. He was the first living artist to have a solo retrospective exhibition at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York in 1971. Annie, on the other hand, started to create textile patterns for companies and had given up weaving by the end of the 1950s. She outlived Joseph by 18 years and continued to promote his and her artwork. In a novel called Ullstein Roman, literally meaning Ullstein novel, by the German author Stan Nadolny, about the Ullstein family from which Annie came, she is described as the most difficult of the family. She wanted to be a bohemian, a revolutionary, an artist. Well, I think she achieved that. In fact, she and Joseph did it even at least twice, once at the Bauhaus and then again at Black Mountain College. At both places, the two artists left a mark and influenced several of their students and friends and helped create a new, a modern understanding of art by playfully experimenting with materials and trying to stay open-minded by forgetting what we know and have been taught. And now, there's nothing left to say. But please tell everyone about my podcast, share, like, subscribe to Spotify, Apple Podcasts and Instagram, and tune in to the next episode of Bauhaus Faces. P.S. I have been recording several new episodes for you about Fritz Kur, the Japanese Bauhausers Michiko and Iwao Yamawaki, and about the third Bauhaus director, Ludwig Mies van der Rohe. So there are several new pieces that you can look forward to. But maybe you have a different Bauhausler in your mind that you want me to present on Bauhaus Faces. Or you are related to a former Bauhaus student or master or are an art historian who researches a Bauhausler. Well, in that case, write a direct message on Instagram to Bauhaus Faces or send me an email to bauhausfaces@gmail.com or via my contact form on the podcast website bauhausfaces.com. By the way, here you can also read a little bit about who I am and what I am doing and find all the Bauhaus Faces episodes. Thanks for listening.